The other thing that I think is true in real estate, especially with social media, is you can absolutely make a lot of income 1 or 2 years being a scumbag, but you won't be in this business long term.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Birmingham Real Estate Investor Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Spencer Sutton, and as always, I have with me Matthew Whitaker. We have a special show for you today. We interviewed a gentleman by the name of Michael Zuber, and he is the author of One Rental at a Time. Now, we interviewed him for another podcast we do in Atlanta called the Atlanta Real Estate Investor Podcast, but we thought that the information was so good, we wanted to share it with you because we think you'll find great value in it, especially if you are looking to build a rental portfolio here in Birmingham, really wherever you are. It doesn't really matter. These lessons that we learned from this episode are very applicable, and we think you'll enjoy it. So listen, if you haven't subscribed, if you hadn't left us a review, we're asking you to leave us a review. It helps other people find us on the podcasting platforms. And then we'll be back with another great guest in a couple of weeks. Hey, what's up, everybody? Really excited to have this guest on here today because we were talking a little bit in the right before in the green room about his journey, and it sounds like something you and I should have learned a long time ago.
And I wish we would have. So we're going to dive into that. Michael Zuber is with us, and he is the author of One Rental at a Time: The Journey to Financial Independence Through Real Estate. And this is really your story. So we're excited to dive in, Michael. Thanks for being with us.
Spencer, Matthew, I appreciate it. Always enjoy, talking about real estate investing, and really like to create belief and inspire people to take action. Because it all started with that first house on Norris Drive. And, in my case, 15 years later, we were able to replace a couple of six-figure incomes and, be financially free. So it is certainly possible.
All right. Good deal. So let's dive right in. I mean, Michael, I know that we've got some questions for you. The first thing I think our audience wants to know is how did you get started in real estate? Like, what was the impetus? What started it all for you?
Yeah, so it's amazing how things kind of repeat, or the rhythm of the market is. So my journey starts with real estate right around my 30th birthday, almost 18 years ago. And it was actually after a pretty significant stock market crash. I had spent the later part of my 20s turning $7,000 into almost $200,000 just by day trading and stocks and all of that. And I subsequently lost about 80% of that seemingly overnight, right? I was day trading stocks. I got the tax records to prove how good I was. Then the market changed and I suddenly wasn't so good. Then I got out. I put my money in a couple of just donkey companies, one called Enron, the next one called WorldCom, which both turned out to be frauds. And little did I know, I was left with $40,000. I walked into a bookstore. They were actually physical bookstores back then. Defeated. Depressed, nervous, scared, and I found this purple book. Purple happens to be my favorite color, called Rich Dad Poor Dad, and I go on to read that book 10 or 11 times in a row, and it changed how I thought, right? It changed how I thought about money. It changed how I thought about cash flow. I came from very humble beginnings, high school graduates for parents, never made any money to speak of, never had any money to speak of. Money was a stressor in my childhood. And the book sets me on a journey. But what the book isn't, it's not a how-to book, right? It talks about two condos. She bought a condo in Oregon, I think, and he bought a condo in Hawaii. And that was it. So I just start falling forward. I start reading everything I can. I waste a year because every book I read after Rich Dad Poor Dad said invest 30 minutes from home. I happen to live in the Silicon Valley, and that's never worked. If you were going to be a cash flow investor, buying 30 minutes anywhere in the Silicon Valley doesn't work. It doesn't work today. Didn't work then. So I had a choice. So we pulled out a California map and we started drawing, circles, 30 minutes, 60 minutes, 90 minutes. And lo and behold, we find a market 2.5 hours away from home driving. So it's a 5-hour day to see one house. And that for us turned into be Fresno, California. And, you know, that's our journey. And I bring up the time because, you know, we had to make a choice. Clearly the Silicon Valley wasn't going to work, but we had to choose. Do we go out of state, which is very common for folks, or do we, you know, find something in California? And I happen to have a career that already put me on a plane 100 nights a year. So I had no interest in getting on a plane again for my investing. So I was comfortable driving. I get asked all the time, why not out of state? Why not out of state? The fact is I already flew enough and I hate flying. So that's why we chose that. And again, the key about Fresno for us is I didn't know anybody. I'd been to Fresno one time when I drove through on the way to Yosemite, which is a national park, but didn't know anybody, no network, didn't know the real estate, didn't know the rental market, nothing. But the house was cheap. It was $107,000, rented for $1,100. And, you know, that starts our journey. So, yeah,
it's awesome.
There's so much to unpack here, Michael. Thank you for sharing that story. One of the things that we have in common that I didn't know is that we both read the book Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and it set us off on our journey to mm-hmm. where we are today. My dad gave it to me in high school, and I read it, and I swore I was always going to be an entrepreneur and run a business. I actually listened to it about a year ago, the Rich Dad Poor Dad book on tape, which would also date all of us, but
yeah, I would know what you mean. The other people would be like, what is he talking about on tape?
I listened to it on audio and I'm like, man, the mindset that they give you and the idea that you want to be on the owning a business and investing your time instead of trading time for money, I think is so important. Can you talk about how you've applied that to your business today?
Yeah. So the mindset, there's so much in that book. You got to kind of find your thing, right? So I'm 30 years old. I have this book. I've now read it 10 or 11 times. This is where I come to. It's like, okay, I'm going to bust my butt during the day because I loved my job and I was paid very well when I executed, right? I was a commissioned salesperson. So when you're good at what you do, you can make a lot of money, right? So I was going to bust my tail from 8 to 8. But what I was going to do on the side of that is, second, I was going to lower my expenses, right? You tie Rich Dad, Poor Dad in with the millionaire next door and you start living below your means, you start to get a lot more money to invest because I start my journey with $40,000. That's all I had after losing $160,000 in the market. And then, you know, we jump in, we start reading and you know, we buy that first house. So Rich Dad, Poor Dad tells me about investing. I still need to do my day job because I'm not going to quit my job. I couldn't replace my income soon enough. I was already in the Silicon Valley. So my monthly nut was, you know, 8 figures because it's crazy expensive to live here. So, you know, that's what I did. And I did not have financial freedom in mind when I started. My number was 10. I thought if I can get to 10 properties in 10 years, I didn't know where that would take me. I just knew when I retired, I'd be okay. Right. I wouldn't have to rely on the government. I wouldn't have to rely on someone else. I'm like, hey, if I get 10 houses, one a year for 10 years, I think we're going to be okay. Right. My daughter can go to college. You know, we can, you know, help her get her first place. I think I'll be okay. And then, you know, you get into this and you get one deal and then two deals and you learn more and, you know, things start to grow. And then you move stuff right at the peak and you go to apartments and, you know, you go from 8 to 80. And, you know, when you really watch the market, you can learn. And, you know, I'm living proof of that. So Rich Dad Poor Dad is certainly the start of the journey.
And that's the great thing about real estate. I mean, it absolutely is a get rich. If you look over the course of time and see all the people that invest in real estate to get and gotten rich doing it. Mm-hmm. But it's not get rich quick. It's a slow build. It does have a exponential return at the end, a long tail to it. And, you know, one of the great things about doing this podcast is we've gotten to talk to a number of people who have stuck with it. But one of the things I think is important that we always tell people when we talk to them on the phone or when they ask us, and the problem we've seen with a lot of newbie people that you didn't do is quit your day job. Mm-hmm. Everybody, when they get in this business, wants to be in it full time because generally they have a passion for it. It seems fun. It seems sexy. But their day job just seems to get in the way of their investments. Mm-hmm. Spencer and I didn't do that, and we crashed really hard. But talk a little bit about the kind of internal struggle, because I know real estate, or at least it sounds like real estate's your passion, but talk mm-hmm. about the internal struggle of you're on a plane, you don't want to be on a plane, mm-hmm. but you know it's the right thing to do so that you can build your passive business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, the good thing I had is I never had the inclination to quit my job. I never had that inclination, even though I hated flying. I hated, you know, parts of it. I knew that I had to build my empire one brick at a time. And I could see how many bricks it was going to take. And it didn't matter if I quit my job. I wasn't going to be able to build any more bricks, right? I wasn't going to be able to manufacture them. I was already investing in a market I didn't know anyone and couldn't do it in the Bay Area. What didn't want to move there, right? There's some things we could have done to lower our monthly expenses. But, you know, my family at the time was entrenched here. My daughter was in school. We didn't want to move her. You know, so my eight-figure monthly nut wasn't going to change. So thankfully, I never had that. I actually think it is a mistake for most people. I think social media, the flashing of the checks, the stacks of paper, the bands, whatever you want to call it, is a disservice. I tell people you need to bust your ass from 8 to 8. You don't have to love it, but somebody's paying you to do that. And then you need to sacrifice other things in your life, especially if you're going to be a buy and hold investor, right? If you're going to be a flipper or a wholesaler and you know, you can live on ramen noodles for a couple of years, go for it. But if you got to remember, right, I start this journey at 30. That means I already have a mortgage payment. Or that means I have a daughter she was probably 8 or 9 at the time, right? We already have a couple of car payments. We already have monthly expenses, you know, and what, we had 40 grand, right? So I could have lived 4 months without a paycheck. I mean, that would have been crazy. So I think most people quitting their jobs are hurting themselves. They are putting too much pressure. They are not allowing themselves to learn a market. They are about to turn real estate from fun and exciting into stressful and dangerous. There's very, 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 very little upside to just quit your job on a whim. However, I am living proof. If you get to the end of the day and you have enough and you walk into work one day and something has changed, you can quit. I had planned to quit when I was 50. Again, I was in sales, as I mentioned earlier, and that meant every year you get a new team, you get a new quota, and potentially a new leader. I walked in after a year. My year ended January 31st. I think February 1st was a holiday or a weekend. So I go to the office February 3rd, realize that I just got dealt the worst hand I would ever want. And in about 15 or 20 seconds, I decide to quit because I have a very intense conversation with my new boss, who I did not trust or respect. And to be fair, he did not trust or respect me. So it was mutual hatred. And I'm like, dude, I'm out. Give me a package. I'm done. So I, you know, texted my wife saying, I'm coming home. I quit. She goes, you just told me you were excited about the year. What happened? I'm like, honey, I'm done. I'm done. So when you get there, when you live below your means, these people flashing Ferraris and Lambos and champagnes and all of that, that is, you don't need that stress, right? My monthly nut has gone down, not up, since retiring, right? It's nice to live comfortable.
So how long was that? How long ago was that you quit your
February
job?
February 3rd of 2018. So 2.5 years.
Okay.
Yeah, that's 2 awesome. Years, 7 months.
And I always tell Spencer to quit taking those pictures in front of his Lamborghini. I'm tired of looking at him.
It's your Lamborghini. I'm just taking pictures.
That's right. He's just posing.
I just rented the Lamborghini.
Well, one of the things that I think you mentioned, which I have personally experienced, is how you tied sleep and cash flow directly together. I would tell our audience, it is so important that you create margin with your cash flow versus living on your cash flow, because you want to talk about a lot of sleepless nights. Back when Spencer and I used to live deal to deal to deal, I think Spencer and I found maybe equal bad investments in the fact that we invested in our own companies that we were flipping houses as your Enron and WorldCom stock. Our stock was about worth the same thing around 2007, 2008. Yeah, but it's very important to create margin and not try to push this thing, because cash flow and lack thereof does absolutely affect your sleep. One of the things I want you to do is kind of take us on this journey of buying one at a time. Mm-hmm. And when I think about this, it kind of brings to mind the book Good to Great.
Sure.
And the flywheel. And it probably feels like you were just building, that it was a slow build at first. And as you get going, the flywheel gets faster and faster and faster. Can you kind of tell us in your own words how it feels to build that?
Yeah. So in the book that you referenced, One Rental at a Time, I kind of broke it into four phases, because you're right, it is kind of that flywheel, good to great, was kind of the framework for it. So the first, what I call first phase or stage, I forget what I called it. I think I called it phase, was just getting started. And for me, that was really two parts of it. Part A was, how did I invest the 40 grand? Well, step one, I put 20% down on my first rental because I didn't know any different. I just, you know, you got to put 20% down. I didn't know. So boom, half my money's gone. That's Norris Drive. Then I realized, you know what? I can get what's called an 80-10-10. So 80% first, 10% second, 10,000, you know, down if it's a 100K purchase. So boom, house number two, house number three, money's gone. What's not said in that story is that took almost 2 years, right? Because I would only do good or great deals. One of the things that I take immense credit for now that I didn't realize I was doing then is I looked at my market every day. I still look at my market every day. I have probably missed less than 20 days in 20 years of looking at my market. And what that allows you to do is you can figure out what's going on in your market. You know what's going on before agents. You can see what's priced low or high. So again, I look at my market every day for about 2 years and I get three deals, but I'm out of money. Good news is this is pre-crash. Lending is pretty loose. I go out and do a cash out refi of house number one, Norris Drive, which I've referenced. I again make a mistake. I assume that banks are conservative. Again, I'm an idiot. They allow me to take out as much cash as I want. So I didn't realize, I didn't run the numbers. I signed the paperwork, you know, because I was probably in another country when I signed it. And I get the first mortgage payment. And I'm like, what the hell? Mortgage payment plus taxes and insurance, which I chose to impound, was like $1,250 or $1,275 or something. The problem was my rent was $1,095. So before I pay property manager, before I do any margin for reserves or bad debt or capital, I'm already negative. Hence, the only picture in the book is something I call no alligators, which a friend of mine drew for me after I retired. Basically, an alligator eating bags of money. So A, never assume a bank is going to be conservative. They won't. Never create or buy a negative cash flow property because, again, we talked earlier about margin, Matthew, and let's just say when it's negative, it only gets worse, right? It was a horrible experience. But again, I take out a pile of cash. I take that pile of cash. I go buy two more. That takes me about another year. Two more cash out refis on the first three properties. So all three of them get cash out refied in about a 2 year period. I end up with eight houses. So now we're at the peak, or what I don't know is the peak, but turns out to be the peak. And I'm struggling to get house number nine, because my accounting and analytical brain will not let me create another negative cash flow property. For example, that first house I bought at 107 is now worth 264. Problem is it rents for the same, right? The cash flow is great at 1095, doesn't cash flow so well at 264. And I'm struggling. I go to a real estate meetup and the speaker talks about small multifamilies. I never looked at them. I didn't know anybody that owned them. I assumed you had to be a multimillionaire to own an apartment. What did I know? Right? Rich Dad Poor Dad didn't talk about apartments. Talked about a couple of condos, right? What do I know? And lo and behold, he introduces me to the concept. I quickly go and look at my market and realize that there's a 5-unit building that I could buy. It's 5 1-unit, one baths for $223. It rents for $600 each, so $3,000. And I go, huh. That's not bad. So I do a 1031 exchange. I 1031 out of Norris Drive, sell it 264, take all the equity, put it on the 223 commercial building. And my cash flow goes up immensely, obviously. No new cash invested. So I am a very simple person. If it works once, I'm going to do it again. So I end up 1031ing out of all of my houses into 80 units. So I go from 8 houses to 80 units, all small apartments. So that's step two, big flywheel, right? And lo and behold, I just complete my last 1031 exchange and the market falls apart. That first house I sold for 264 retrades at 75 4 years after I sold it, right? So big crash. I'm sitting in apartments. So yeah, my net worth takes a hit, but again, my cash flows through the roof, right? And you know, that's the first big learning for me is if you want to overpay for something I own, I'll sell it. I've sold houses when they were high, and in 2019, I sold apartments when they were high. I'm not tied to anything. I buy things intending to own forever, but I watch my market every day. And when stuff gets stupid, I sell. I either sell for cash or 1031 to something else. So that's another lesson that people need to realize. If I would have just held those first 8 houses, you know, I might have 12 or 13 houses today, but I wouldn't be financially free, right? So this buy and hold forever doesn't always work, right? If it's overpriced, sell it, do something else. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, there's so many lessons in here. I think you're undervaluing all the lessons. I was just writing them down as you were talking. I think the first one is very Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett approach to investing, in that I'm only buying great deals. I'm only going to go buy. They always talk about the punch card method of investing. Hey, if you could only invest in, just to translate it into our business, in 20 real estate deals, you would be very discerning on using one of your punch cards. And it sounds like you've really adopted that.
I think that strategy I've referenced before when I teach, and that's the whole thing about learning your market. I look at my market every day because every market has an average deal point. There's either you go find average, and it takes a while. That's what people hate. Oh my God, it takes me forever. Well, it takes you forever timeline, but it's like 15 minutes a day. You can learn your market in 15 minutes a day when you tighten the scope, you get focused, and you get repetitive.
Well, it's,
but you have to do it over years.
And it's funny that you say that, because that reminds me again of Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett, because they read voraciously for 4 or 5 hours a day. So they're studying their market, but they only do 1 to 2 deals a year.
Exactly.
And so they're just waiting on deals to, which gets into another lesson I think you've shared with us, is the buy box, right? Mm-hmm. They're waiting for deals to basically slip into their buy box, and they're patiently waiting for that.
Yep. And then when it comes, doing.
And you that's what they say is, hey, when it falls into our buy box, we're going to bet big on that deal. And it sounds exactly like that. Amen. You've taken that same approach.
Yep. Warren Buffett fan.
We did not have that approach, Matthew.
We had the, I don't even know what approach we had. We had the Lamborghini and Ferrari throwing dollars out the window approach.
I mean, Michael, I remember buying houses, and we were wholesaling houses. Matthew and I both were doing that. And if I couldn't wholesale it, I stuck it in a rental portfolio. Like, that is the worst.
Yes, probably not a good approach.
It's a horrible approach.
I'm going to keep all the sucky deals that I've done in my portfolio and sell all the good ones to everybody else.
But all we saw was the market doing this.
Yeah.
Like, timing is a big part of your story. I mean, timing of well, it was the discipline to say, hey, I'm willing to sell at this and go find this. But you did it at the right time.
Twice now. And you got to watch every day. And then again, I really believe it. When the market's overpriced or somebody's willing to overpay for any of my assets, I will happily sell. It was houses in 07, 08, and it was apartments in late 2019. And again, when you watch every day, it's not subtle. It'll smack you in the face. It's like, it's like, okay, pay attention.
I think I'm still not done with all your lessons. I've wrote down another one, that leverage can expand your gains, but it can also expand your losses too. Oh, being cognizant of that, Spencer and I sound like you expanded your gains. Spencer and I did a great job back in 07, 08 of expanding our losses.
Yeah.
And then the last thing, because I'd love to know what a day looks like. It sounds like you're constantly thinking about your portfolio, which you talked about, hey, you know, if somebody's willing to overpay me for it. Talk about how you think about your portfolio. Do you have a spreadsheet? How does that get done?
Yeah. I look at my market every day still. I happen to be a morning person. My wife's a night owl. So I always get about 3 hours in the morning where I'm up and she's asleep, frankly. So that's when I do all of my work, even today, right? Both of us being financially free and all of that. So I spend 3 hours in my business in the morning, looking for more deals, because you never stop, right? I believe the deal of the year, I call it the deal of the decade, comes around every year, but you got to be looking for it, right? So I'm always looking. So that's where I start. It's always with acquisition. And then I figure out what's going on in my market. For example, clean properties are being sold for ridiculous prices today. So I happen to take a fixer-upper that I purchased here recently, fix it up nice for an FHA buyer, put it out on the market because people were overbidding and they raised the price by 10%. I'll take that fat profit. I think there's a little room for FHA buyers for the next 6 to 12 months, so I'll take that profit. The other thing I did this year, because residential lending is pretty easy, is I found my worst performing small multifamily. It happened to be a triplex. So I put that on the market. So I take the opportunity to manage it. But as far as actively working in my portfolio, you'd probably be shocked. I spend less than 2 hours on it a month because I have a system. I don't live in my market. I have a property management team. I work very hard for processes and procedures and exceptions. Most of my time is about growing the portfolio. I occasionally approve expenses if it's above a threshold. I occasionally approve applicant if there's a question mark. But for the most part, my active portfolio is not taking up a lot of time.
You mentioned your property manager. I'd be curious what you look for in a property manager.
Well, that's taken me a while, right? So the first thing that's in the book is I fired my first five, which for the most part, probably was my fault, right? I didn't know what to do. I didn't know anybody in Fresno. So I said yes to the first three that were there, right? I didn't even interview them. So stupid I was. But what I look for in a property manager is communication and speed and then processes. Communication is number one, especially since I'm out of market. The reason I fired the first five is at some point, because again, I'm lucky I could drive there, so it's not a plane ticket and nights and hotels. I would tell them I'm coming one Saturday or Sunday. I'd come do a walkthrough, right? And then I would go back the very next Saturday or Sunday and not tell them I'm coming. It was amazing what happened in a week. That's not okay. So those are things. So communication is key. Processes. So we have a checkpoint every Monday and Friday for usually 5 to 10 minutes. If it needs to be longer, it's longer. I get my reports when I ask for them the way I like them. Again, time doesn't, in real estate, just like when I was selling, bad information doesn't get better with time. If something bad is going on, I expect a phone call. I don't care if it's 11 o'clock at night. If I don't want to pick up my phone, I won't pick up my phone. But you leave a message. Hey, it's 11:15. I'm standing in front of your house. It's on fire. I've had one of those calls. It happens. I don't want to hear about it in the local paper or something. Hey, is that my house they took a picture of? Right, that would not be good. Communication is the number one thing. The one thing I didn't appreciate the first 5 years of real estate, I thought the answer lived in my computer, right? Excel or looking at, Google Maps or Realtor or whatever it would be today. Real estate is a people business. Even if you're an out-of-state investor, real estate's a people business. And not only is it who do you know, but who in the market knows you? The only deals I've been able to do in this crazy market with less than 1 month of inventory is from people I've worked with over the last couple of decades. They said, hey, you did me right last time. I got a pocket listing. It's what you buy. Are you interested? Simple yes, no answer. So you really need to look at this is how many people in the market know you, right? If you're in Atlanta or Birmingham or that's where you're investing, but you live in New York or Texas or California or any other state, how many people can you say that know you and know what you're looking for? Get off your ass and get on some local real estate meetups and introduce yourself. And, don't say, hey, this is what I hate. Hi, my name is Michael Zuber. I invest in Atlanta. Call me when you have a deal. What? How do you know what a deal? That's insulting. Because if I ever find a deal in my market, trust me, I'll find a way to get it done. So you should say, hi, my name is Michael Zuber. I invest in Atlanta. I invest in this zip code or that zip code, 3-bedroom, 4-bedroom houses between this and this, above this freeway, below that freeway. I don't know what that is in Atlanta, but some criteria. Get focused, get specific. And again, it all ties back to learning your market. Whatever you're doing to learn or watch your market, you should tell people. Because you never know when that off-market deal could come your way, when somebody's next door neighbor's mother passed away and they can sell it to you. It's all about not only who you know, which too many people talk about, but how many people in Atlanta know you if you're an out-of-state investor. That's key.
I totally agree. I've been talking to even my team lately about how important, real estate to me is two things. It's about meeting a lot of people, because it very much is a relationship networking business. Like, everybody wants to know everybody in the real estate business. I don't know if that's true in other businesses. I hadn't really honestly been in a bunch of other businesses. And then it's all about reputation after that. So once you start to build the network, then it's about making sure you secure your reputation. Of course, that I know crosses all sorts of industry lines, but real estate to me is so easy to network. Why don't more people do it?
Well, there's two things in that statement. Again, just to quote Warren Buffett and Munger again, just because, you know, we're on a roll. Warren Buffett talks about it taking a decade to build a relationship or a reputation and 5 minutes to ruin it. That is very true in real estate. The other thing that I think is true in real estate, especially with social media, is you can absolutely make a lot of income 1 or 2 years being a scumbag, but you won't be in this business long term.
Yep.
You burn a couple of bridges. You take advantage of a couple of people just to make a buck. I hope you enjoy doing something else, because it won't be real estate for the long term. So,
and real estate is a very small world. I think everybody thinks this is this huge world, but because it has so many niche pieces to it, that each little niche area of real estate is a very small world. Even if you're talking about, I would imagine New York or Northern California, everybody knows everybody in that little niche piece of the world. So if you're talking about single family houses or small multifamily, there's not a ton of people there and everybody knows everybody. That's why it's so easy to get to know everybody.
Absolutely.
But it's also so easy to ruin a reputation really fast.
Amen. Yeah. Don't sacrifice reputation ever. If you want to do this long term, never sacrifice reputation.
So when you were thinking about becoming financially free, and you did that a couple or 3 years ago, talk a little bit about a day in your life now in terms of, you know, you don't have to get up. I know you do get up and you still run your business, but I mean, what are some things that's afforded you because you had the discipline for 18 years to build this business? I'd be curious about what those rewards look like.
Yeah. So actually nobody ever asked that kind of question. That's a good one. So my day in the life is pretty easy. I tell everybody every day's Friday to me, or every day's Saturday, whatever you want. Cause it all blends together for me. 7 days a week. I mean, what is today? Tuesday, I think.
It's Saturday. I know very well what day it is. Of course, I've got school age kids too, so they constantly reminded me what day it is.
There you go. I don't have that. My daughter's already out of the house. So yeah, so I get up by 6:30 every day without an alarm clock. I haven't had an alarm clock wake me up in 15 or 16 years. It's just my body's up at that time. I spend the first hour of the day reading about what's going on in the financial world. CNBC, Bloomberg, Wall Street Journal, Seeking Alpha, whatever crosses my plate. Because I think, again, part of being a real estate investor is you have to know what's going on with the consumer. Why? The consumer is my number one competitor. They're my number one customer and my number one competitor. And then I'm trying to figure out what's going on with cost of capital, because that's the biggest expense I have in my business. So cost of capital is going to be really easy for the next couple of years. It's going to be cheap. But you got to figure out what's going on with the customer, both from rental and consumers. Right now, you're seeing space is good. You're seeing urban flight, right? These are all things that we would not be talking about in January or February. Then I have to ask myself, well, what does that mean? What does it mean for my business? What does it mean? How can I use this to make money? Right? There's all kinds of things you can do. But again, I have been doing this for 20 years every morning. I mean, like Christmas morning, Father's Day morning, birthdays, same deal, right? Always. And that allows you to make decisions, right? I decided to sell a single family home that would have been a great rental for a higher price because FHA buyers are the only lending market working, and I can make a quick extra $20,000. Okay, you know, I'll take the profit if you're going to artificially give me a bump. So that's my morning. So by 7:30 or 7, yeah, usually by 7:30, I record my daily financial news. I like I said, I've been doing this for 20 years because I'm retired now. I actually recorded a daily financial news episode at 7:30 every morning live on my YouTube channel, which is called One Rental at a Time. Then I usually do an interview with another expert around 8. So usually by 9:30, I'm having breakfast. I'm working out by 11, showering, whatnot by 1. And then the rest of the day is whatever Olivia and I want to do. It's a pretty nice life.
That's nice.
It sounds very Gary Keller like. Gary Keller has his, I listened to a podcast with him and Tim Ferriss, and he talks about his morning. Like, he gets everything done in the morning.
Yep.
And then that allows him after lunch just essentially be at the mercy of his family, at the mercy of maybe people in his business are kind of driving him to do things. But it's all about getting the one most important thing done, which for you is your study time. Your investment time, making sure that there's no deals that have slid into your buy box that morning.
Yep,
that's some good stuff.
You know, we have a lot of Michael. We've got a lot of investors that call us. You know, they're asking about Atlanta. They're asking about the market. Mm-hmm. I know that you invested, 2.5 hours away from your house. What kind of advice, though, would you have for someone who is looking to invest from out of state? So we talk with a lot of people from California who are looking at Birmingham or Atlanta or whatever. Sure. So what's your advice to those people?
Well, there's a couple of things. First and foremost, I talk to those people all the time, right? Talk to, meaning physically, or communicate via one of the many messaging platforms. Too many of you, meaning the out-of-state investors, are focused on cheap. I promise you, you can go broke with cheap, right? Yes, Palo Alto, California has a median home price of $2.4 million. That is freaking stupid. And then you go to Detroit and you think you can buy, oh, I'll buy five houses for 20 grand each. Well, you want to light 100 grand on fire, right? Because that's maybe what you do, right? So don't get enamored with cheap. That's my first advice. I would say 7 out of 10 out-of-state investors that I communicate have had horrible experiences. Horrible. Because they focused on cheap. So that's the first thing. Second thing is, I would never ask an investor to invest in a market they're not willing to go to, right? I still have people calling me up saying, I'm not going to name cities, but I'm going to invest in city X. I go, great. When are you planning to go there? And they almost turn their nose at me like, oh, I'm never going there. Oh, I'm sorry. If you're not willing to go there, why is your money there? I mean, that's just dumb. That's stupid. And then lastly, I think what we're seeing now in this environment is clearly the United States is tilting. Red state, South, right? Lower taxes. Georgia's looking pretty good on the map. Texas, Nevada. That is a investable trend. I think it helps with appreciation. I think it helps with rental growth. I just think, generally speaking, you're seeing the numbers, right? New York and California are seeing exit. Yep. Ask a deeper question if I missed something.
No, I think it's great. I also agree that people are moving to the South too, where we have offices all across the Southeast, and we've just seen a big increase in occupancy lately. And we just feel like people are moving South. People are moving, like you say, out of urban areas and wanting more space. My father-in-law would tell you the invent of the air conditioner has also helped let people move further South. But
yeah, the AC and Zoom.
That's right.
Well, I can't tell you how many nuggets. This has been great. I really appreciate you getting on with us. If somebody didn't get at least one piece of advice they can take away and apply to their business, they weren't really listening. So thank you so much for your time, and thank you for doing this for everyone.
You got it. Enjoy, guys.
All right, everybody. Listen, if you want to get in touch or you want to learn more about Michael and his business, check out One Rental at a Time. He's got a YouTube page. His book, you can buy it on Amazon. His website is onerentalatatime.com. So I would encourage you to check him out. And then if you enjoyed this episode, be sure to leave us a review. Give us a 5-star review. And we look forward to seeing you on the next episode.